Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Monday, May 22nd, 2017. Donald Trump is on a visit to Israel and the Palestinian territories. When his plane touched down in Israel today, Trump exchanged warm greetings with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and said, "I have found new reasons for hope." He went to the Western Wall in Jerusalem's Old City. He said that visit will always stay with him.
Words fail to capture the experience.
He had an encounter with Israel's education minister, Naftali Bennett, head of the Nationalist Jewish Home Party, who said the United States should recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This isn't in the cards during this visit. Last year, while campaigning, Trump promised to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, but the Palestinians also claim East Jerusalem as their capital, and previous U.S. administrations have said the area's fate must be decided through negotiations. Trump meets with Palestinian President Abbas on Tuesday. One theme continually emerged at Trump's meetings in Israel and over the weekend in Saudi Arabia, a coordinated bashing of Iran. Iran, which held elections over the weekend, put moderates in office, re-elected Iranian President Hassan Rouhani for four more years. Rouhani today described relations with the U.S. as a curvy road. He says the Islamic Republic is still waiting to understand what the Trump administration wants, and it's waiting for the administration to be civil. He described the meeting Trump had in Saudi Arabia as a show-off, saying the issue of terrorism can't be solved through giving money to superpowers. Here's Trump today bashing Iran with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu.
There are many, many things that can happen now that would never have been able to happen before, and we understand that very well. That includes advancing prosperity, defeating the evils of terrorism, and facing the threat of an Iranian regime that is threatening the region and causing so much violence and suffering.
And warning Iran, Trump said the country should be grateful to the U.S.
Iran negotiated a fantastic deal with the previous administration, a deal that is unbelievable from any standpoint. Some people don't understand even how it could be even thought of. And instead of being thankful and saying thank you, because they were in serious trouble, I think they would have failed, totally failed, within 6 months. We gave them a lifeline, and we not only gave them a lifeline, we gave them wealth and prosperity. And we also gave them an ability to continue with terror and with all of the things they've been doing. Because no matter where we go, we see the signs of Iran in the Middle East. No matter where we go, whether it's Syria, where we were really forced to shoot the 59 missiles a few weeks ago, no matter what area we're in, we see Yemen, Iraq, no matter where we are, we see the signs, every sign, whether it's soldiers, whether it's money and guns, it's around. And instead of saying thank you to the United States, they now feel emboldened. Maybe they figure the deal was so good, we can do it every time. They can't do it, believe me. But it was a terrible thing for the United States to enter that deal. And believe me, Iran will never have a nuclear weapon, that I can tell you.
On Sunday, with the meeting between King Salman of Saudi Arabia and Donald Trump, there was concern over Trump's Muslim bashings that it would interfere with discussions in that Muslim nation. But no, Iran bashing was the topic at hand. King Salman.
The Iranian regime has been the spearhead of global terrorism since the Khomeini Revolution until now. We have been in this country for 300 years and have known no terrorism or extremism until the Khomeini Revolution began in 1979. Iran has turned down all good neighborliness initiatives offered by our nations with goodwill. It has responded with expansionist aspirations, criminal practices, and interference in the internal affairs of other countries, thus violating the principles of international law, good neighborliness, and mutual respect and coexistence. The Iranian regime thought that our silence was weakness and our wisdom was retreat until we had enough of its hostile practices and interference, as we witness in Yemen and other countries in the region. As we say this, we assert at the same time our respect and appreciation for the Iranian people. We do not hold people responsible for the actions of their regime.
And Iranophobia stirred up again by Donald Trump.
Starving terrorists of their territory, of their funding, and the false allure of the craven ideology will be the basis for easily defeating them. But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three: safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran. From Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen, Iran funds arms and trains terrorists, militias, and other extremist groups that spread destruction and chaos across the region. For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is a government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this very room.
By casting Iran as the enemy, the Saudis and the Trump administration are calling the Iran deal into question, and they are putting the U.S. alongside Saudi Arabia and Israel against Shia Iran, which stands with Yemen. By supporting the Sunni-led Saudis, the U.S. is supporting the Saudi-backed war against Yemen, effectively starving the people of Yemen by blocking entry for humanitarian aid. It's a situation which is only getting worse, Daniel Johnson reports.
Already struggling from more than 2 years of war, Yemen is now in the grip of a full-blown cholera epidemic that threatens to sink what's left of the country's health system. The disease has already hit 18 out of 23 governorates, and the fear is that it will spread further after coinciding with the rainy season. Dr. Nevio Zagaria is the World Health Organization's representative in Yemen.
I have to admit that when I see the data that I saw this morning that are just released, these are data that have not yet been officially released, we just got a few minutes ago, really are keeping us, I have to admit, by surprise. The speed of the resurgence of the cholera epidemic is unprecedented.
The current disease outbreak has its roots in an original episode last October. It peaked in December 2016 and never fully went away, amid conflict between government forces and Houthi-backed rebels that has left over half the country's medical facilities closed or damaged and the economy in freefall. The lack of local health centres and the fact that staff haven't been paid in 7 months have left Yemenis with no option but to seek help from hospitals, which WHO says are now overwhelmed. In recent days, UN staff have reported that patients have been left writhing in agony on ward floors. Additional problems include massive damage to the country's sewage and electricity infrastructure, which have left the water supply contaminated. A WHO map showing cholera hotspots in Yemen indicates the highest number of suspected cases, more than 6,000, in the capital city, Sana'a. Few communities have been left untouched by the disease, which is characterized by severe diarrhea that can kill within hours if not treated promptly. In some places, the fatality rate is as high as 4-5%, and WHO is extremely concerned that the disease is being passed from one person to another. WHO's Dr. Zagaria again.
But if the transmission go on at this speed, I think that we need to revise the figure and we need to expect something that can go up over 200,000, 250,000 cases over the next 6 months. in addition to the 50,000 cases that already occur. So you can understand by yourself that with this number, the price that we will pay in terms of life will be extremely, extremely high. We have to do more.
In response to the crisis, WHO has begun the task of setting up 350 cholera treatment centres and 2,000 oral rehydration points. It's also focusing on tracing infection hotspots to reduce the risk of disease transmission. The agency has stressed that the scale of the threat is too big for the Yemeni authorities to do on their own, and that to date only around 20% of its $22 million cholera appeal has been met. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia uses U.S.-made planes and bombs to enforce the food and aid blockade on Yemen. Over the weekend, Donald Trump sealed nearly $110 billion in deals with the Saudis to buy U.S. arms to help it counter Iran, options running as high as $350 billion over 10 years. With news of this, defense stocks here in the U.S. soared to an all-time high. The Trump administration ties to the defense industry and defense contractors are numerous. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis was a director of defense contracts at General Dynamics. John Kelly, Secretary of Homeland Security, had leadership positions in three defense contractors. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos is connected through her brother, Eric Prince, founder of Blackwater, the mercenary contractor. Peter Thiel, who co-founded PayPal, and he sits on the Facebook board of directors. He's co-founder of Palantir, which received Pentagon contracts. Just a few of those in the Trump administration linked to the defense industry. And you're listening to the News of Our Listeners, sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. In other Trump news, former White House National Security Advisor Mike Flynn will decline to comply with a subpoena from the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating possible Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. He will invoke his Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. This was first reported by the Associated Press, citing sources close to Flynn. Attorneys for Flynn say a daily escalating public frenzy against him and the Justice Department's appointment of a special counsel have created a legally dangerous environment for him to cooperate with a Senate investigation. Meanwhile, Representative Elijah Cummings on the House Oversight Committee says documents that he reviewed suggest that former National Security Advisor Flynn lied to federal security clearance investigators about the source of payments he received from the Russian state-sponsored television network, RT. Cummings says Flynn told investigators during a 2016 security clearance review that a trip to Moscow was funded by U.S. companies, where the actual source of funds was the Russian media propaganda arm RT. The Trump administration today said it will extend until January a humanitarian program which allowed roughly 58,000 Haitians to live in the U.S., but it is hinting that further extensions are unlikely. Temporary protected status was given to Haitians living in the U.S. after the 2010 earthquake devastated parts of that country. Haitians granted the protection can live and work in the U.S. without fear of deportation, but that's only for the next 6 months. Haitian participation in the program had been regularly renewed for 18-month intervals, and the latest extension expires in July. In other Trump news, Trump's budget proposal includes huge cuts to food stamps. The budget would drive millions of people off of food stamps. It's part of a new wave of spending cut proposals that are already getting panned by lawmakers in both parties on Capitol Hill. The blueprint for the 2018 budget year expands the budget for the military, but it cuts benefit programs such as Medicaid, federal employee pensions, welfare benefits, and farm subsidies. Uncertainty over the future of the health care bill for millions has grown deeper today as insurers released a blueprint for stabilizing wobbly markets, and the Trump administration is left in limbo over the fate of billions of dollars in federal payments. At the federal courthouse, the administration and House Republicans asked appeals judges for a 90-day extension. That in a case which involves federal payments to reduce deductibles and copayments for people with modest incomes victims who buy their own policies. The $7 billion in cost-sharing subsidies remains under a cloud as insurers finalize their premium requests for next year. And there's a new report out from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It says the Republican health bill, which passed in the House, would hurt seniors and people with disabilities as states deal with Medicaid cuts by eliminating home and community-based services. Andrea Sears reports.
With the per capita cap on Medicaid spending that would be imposed under the American Health Care Act, states would be forced to make cuts. And according to Judy Solomon with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Home and Community-Based Services, or HCBS, which allows seniors and people with disabilities to get the care they need in their homes, would be at the top of the list.
Most HCBS are what Medicaid considers optional services. In other words, states don't have to provide them, in contrast to care in a nursing home, which is mandatory and states must provide.
The report says almost 300,000 New Yorkers participate in HCBS, and capping Medicaid would force many into much more expensive nursing home care. Marty Ford with The Arc says the impact of a cap on Medicaid would be devastating for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. She claims it would undo decades of work by states to move people out of institutions and into the community, as federal law requires.
It would be a major step backward in a violation of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Olmstead. And based on the Americans with Disabilities Act, unnecessary segregation is discrimination.
In some states, people with disabilities already spend 8 to 10 years on waiting lists for home and community-based services. David Sertner with AARP notes that seniors and people with disabilities now account for 60% of Medicaid spending. He says caps would shift costs to states, state taxpayers, and to families who can't afford to pay for care without this additional support.
The end result would be dramatic cuts to program eligibility, program services, or both, ultimately harming some of our nation's most vulnerable citizens.
Nationally, nearly 3 million people rely on HCBS to receive care at home instead of nursing homes or other institutions. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Continuing with the effect of Trump care, officials at Planned Parenthood say thousands of women in the Hudson Valley could lose access to health services, services like cancer screening and STD testing, if a provision that cuts off funding becomes law. And there's anger in upstate New York and Ulster County, where John Faso represents the 19th Congressional District. Faso defeated Zephyr Teachout for that seat. He's on record opposing the defunding provision and voting against it in committee, but since then he has cast 3 votes for versions of Trump care that included it. He has faced town halls where community members say he's not listening to his constituents. Continuing with local news, we turn now to Ben Max with Gotham Gazette for This Week in New York State and New York City Politics.
It's another busy week in New York politics. A lot of the focus this week is on the Bronx, where Mayor Bill de Blasio and the senior staff in his administration are doing the second week of their City Hall in Your Borough series. They previously spent a week on Staten Island. This week they're in the Bronx and they're addressing specific concerns to that borough.
When you're on Staten Island, you hear people talk about, you know, the quote-unquote forgotten borough. And we've tried in this administration to make very clear that that borough is on our mind all the time and tried to show it through action. Well, a lot of people in the Bronx over many years who I've spoken to feel the Bronx is the forgotten borough. And, you know, there's an honest reason for that. And I don't think it's unfair to say out loud that there were, I think, for too many decades in this city, there was a tendency for the city government to focus too little on the Bronx, too little on the outer boroughs in general, too much on Manhattan, with all due respect to Manhattan and its needs. We came into office saying we needed a 5-borough government, a 5-borough economy. We needed to create balance and fairness in the equation. I say that as a proud Brooklynite, but I would say people in the Bronx feel just as strongly that the work of the city government has to be about equity in every way. And that sense of distributing resources and focusing policies fairly, that was lacking for a long time. We got a lot to do. It will not all be corrected overnight. But we're adamant in this administration that we want to right those wrongs.
While the mayor's schedule is not completely clear at this point, we know that he'll be making Bronx-specific announcements about resources and policy. He'll also be holding a town hall one night this week on Wednesday. And as he did on Staten Island, he'll be holding some office hours and a resource fair for Bronx constituents on Tuesday morning from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., where local Bronx residents can come in and talk directly to agency commissioners, and some of them will even talk to the mayor directly about their issues. It's the way that the Blasio administration is putting a local touch on city government and bringing it directly to people in each of the five boroughs. Some people, of course, have noticed that de Blasio has decided to do the new series during his election year. The mayor has said it's nothing but outreach to constituents and a chance to get more local. Even as he's been holding town halls all across the city for about a year and a half, he's decamping in each borough for a week, bringing a flood of city resources and attention to the issues of each of the five boroughs. It's also rumored that the mayor will attend his first Yankees game since becoming mayor at some point this week. The team is home all week, and we'll see which game the mayor decides to attend. We're also watching Albany this week, where the state legislature is in its final 15 days or so of session this year. It lasts until about mid-June. There's three session days this week, and then about a 10-day break as legislators will be in their home districts and also taking some time off, surely, for the Memorial Day weekend holiday. But in Albany, since the budget passed in early April, there's been very little action. And of course, we're assuming that again, this year, there will be what's often referred to as the big, ugly batch of legislation passed right at the end of legislative session in June. What the issues that will be tackled are unclear. There's a lot of talk from Democrats in the Assembly about their priorities and Republicans in the Senate about theirs, but it's unclear where the compromise will be. For his part, Governor Cuomo's been spending very little time or attention on the state capitol. Cuomo had said back in April that he basically got everything done that he wanted to in the budget, which was jam-packed with policy and programs. However, one big item missing was ethics and voting reform, which the governor had said was a priority but didn't seem to focus on too much. And then we're also watching this week as the flare-up over the MTA continues here in New York City, and a lot of fingers are being pointed at Governor Cuomo, who of course has a lot of sway over the MTA. Mayor Bill de Blasio made very forceful comments last week about how New Yorkers should focus on Governor Cuomo if they're unhappy with the situation in the subways or even the buses, but especially the subways, which have been breaking down at an even faster pace than usual of late. Of course, the governor and his team have sniped back at the mayor, saying that he's not very good at math or facts in one of their typically personal types of statements when they are criticized. The governor has also pointed to major investment in the MTA and other infrastructure under his watch, but critics continue to say that the governor's not doing enough quickly enough through the MTA to improve the subways. And at the city council this week, they're wrapping up hearings on Mayor Bill de Blasio's executive budget proposal. When those hearings do wrap up, we then go to mostly closed-door negotiations before the mayor and the city council agree on a new city budget by the July 1st deadline. There's a lot of whispers that the budget deal will be done quite early this year. It was done early last year, and it may be even earlier this year, probably in early June. There's a variety of other committee hearings at the city council this week, and a full rundown of panel events and other press conferences that we give you at Gotham Gazette. Ben Max, WBAI News, New York.
In other local news, organizers of New York's Puerto Rican Day Parade are standing firm in a decision to honor a nationalist recently released from prison. In a statement today, organizers said honoring Oscar Lopez Rivera will create awareness on issues that affect the Puerto Rican community, even if controversial. The 74-year-old was released last week after serving 35 years in prison. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Monday, May 27th, 2017. The news was produced with Andrea Sears, Ben Max, and Reggie Johnson. We're going out with a hymn of Puerto Rico sung by Maida Belen. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.